Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Kate Burdett. Coming up, the Ohio State Fair is about to open, and we'll get a preview of what's in store this year. Also, Jay Fox will speak with experts about consumer spending and infrastructure. Plus, Doug Petcash from Face the State will have a look at state politics. First up on Columbus Perspective, Alicia Schultz is the Deputy Director of Operations and Experience for the Ohio State Fair, and this is a busy time for her. We're getting ready for the Ohio State Fair to open this week. Alicia, thanks for joining us on Columbus Perspective.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate the opportunity to share my excitement for the Ohio State Fair with you and all of your listeners.
I think we're all pretty excited. So let's start at the beginning. What's new at the fair this year?
Well, truly, it's like the entire property's gotten a little bit of a makeover. We, for fairgoers who've been coming the last couple of years, may remember that we've had a couple of buildings that have been behind construction fencing. And all of those construction projects are actually going to be complete when you come to the Ohio State Fair this year. So we've got two brand new buildings with exciting new exhibits that I can share a little bit about inside of both of those buildings. We've got renovations to four other buildings, the brand new entry gate that everyone walked through last year. And then we've also got a new custom Ohio themed carousel. So many new things, as well as new stages, new performers, new entertainers, all of that will really be changing every single experience that you have at the Ohio State Fair while keeping your favorite traditions like the Butter Cow, Natural Resources Park, and the livestock shows. So we've got your fair favorites and plenty more of the fair you love.
Well, tell us about some of the new buildings on the fair campus.
Yeah, I'm so excited about these. So the two new buildings we have, one is called the Ohio Showcase Building, and it kind of serves two purposes. Half of that building is programmed in conjunction with Ohio History Connection, our neighbors on the north side of the property, which, as an aside, the Ohio History Center and Ohio Village are open totally free for fairgoers with fair admission every day of the Ohio State Fair from 10 to 5. So great partnership. But what we're doing with them in this new building is a brand new Shaping Ohio exhibit. So on the first level of the building, there's an immersive 360-degree film telling the story of Ohio that fairgoers can go sit, enjoy some air conditioning, and learn the story of Ohio, and then go upstairs to see the Shaping Ohio exhibit that's really interactive and tells the story of our state, people, places, communities, everything. And it's totally free for fairgoers. The other side of that building is a brand new food hall. And so we have Ohio restaurants that are going to be a part of that food hall. And again, a nice air-conditioned area where you can purchase food from Schmitz, one of our great partners that's been at the fair for some time, but also Sweet Carrot, Marlowe's Cheese Steaks, Daisy's Fish Shack, The Cheesecake Girl, and Glass City Pizzeria. So a lot of really good food options in the new Ohio Showcase Building.
Wow.
And yeah, I mean, it's just going to be so much. And of course, we've still got hundreds of food options all throughout the grounds, and another fairgoer favorite, the Taste of Ohio Cafe, which has been relocated to its new permanent home in the brand new Ohio Agriculture Center. So that's the one fairgoers will know, where they've gotten things like the wild flavors of deviled eggs in the past, or the ribeye sandwich served by, you know, an Ohio beef farmer, the chicken and noodle meals, lamb, dairy. All of those will all be available in the Taste of Ohio Cafe and the new Ohio Agriculture Center. That building as a whole is really kind of an immersive agriculture experience. So when you first come in, that's where the Taste of Ohio Cafe is. But we've also got a brand new area that's programmed in partnership with the Ohio Department of Agriculture called the Ohio Proud Showcase, where there will be areas where people can, of course, learn about agriculture, but also cooking demonstrations to learn how you can cook different Ohio foods and prepare those in your home. A lot of different educational activities that are going to be in there, as well as Ohio coffee and Ohio wine as well, that will be available. Then you get into the main exhibit hall portion, and all of Ohio's agricultural partners have really come together to make this exhibit absolutely amazing. And the Ohio Farm Bureau's really taken the leadership. And so this new exhibit, it's called Imagine Ag. And it is absolutely just phenomenal. You'll walk through a big ray of sunshine into the exhibit, and there's different sections where people can do things like fly a real drone to learn how farmers use drones in their regular operations. You can see the size of a real life giant combine that's in the area, and you can learn about Ohio weather and how that impacts our crops, as well as the innovations in agriculture that have been discovered right here in Ohio. And then there's a creature comforts trail that shows you how animals are cared for, things like cooling mats, and takes you back to our OVMA Animal Life and Learning Center. And that's where baby animals are born during the Ohio State Fair. So you'll be able to see, you know, cute little baby piglets and chicks hatching, as well as sheep and lots of other species during the fair. So it's a great experience because often in urban areas, you don't necessarily get to witness the miracle of a livestock birth, like people on farms might be able to see. And so you can see all of that in the fair, as well as our horticulture and floriculture exhibits, where we've got a lot of really talented people growing and putting together beautiful floral displays that will all be on show in that brand new Ohio Agriculture Center.
Well, you've mentioned baby animals and all of the eating opportunities, so I'm covered for the fair, but I am sure there are some other features that you want to touch on. What else is new at the fair this year, Alicia?
Yeah, we have a ton of different exhibits that are new. I mentioned earlier new entertainers. So we have a couple of entertainment stages that are at the fair, two new stages this year. So one is our new Town Square Amphitheater stage, and that will have the Comedy Farm Magic Review every single day, which is a fun interactive show that families will enjoy, as well as the Salsa Steel, a steel drum band that will perform there, and others every single day. We also have our new Cardinal stage. And so there are different performers there, like Groovy Guy, who's a juggler, but also musicians that change throughout the Ohio State Fair. And we've got our stages like the Work at Health Gazebo stage that will return and has a ton of different entertainers and performers that are changing throughout the fair. So we've got Jason Devod, kind of a traditional circus man, strongman type act. And we've got a yo-yo guy who will be in there. So we've got a lot of really fun entertainers that are at the stages. We also have a new glass blowing exhibit that's located near our absolutely amazing Cox Fine Arts Center. So that Cox Fine Arts Center is where Ohioans have entered a juried art competition and have their products that are being showed. So you can see the beautiful mixed media artwork and various sculptures and things that Ohioans have created. But outside of that, you can see this new glass blowing exhibit. And then near that area on our historic district at the fair as well, you can visit, we have a mobile museum that is available for people to learn more about the United States and the history of our country as we celebrate America 250 this year. And right in that area is another amazing, exciting new thing that's a part of our construction projects, and that's that brand new Ohio-themed carousel. And every single animal on that carousel is a representation of Ohio. So it's not just horses. It's a lot of different characters and menagerie that represent our great state. And it's actually all been hand-carved and painted right here in Ohio by a company in Marion. So there's not very many companies that do that anymore. And we're thrilled that we're able to do that right here in our home state to create this permanent carousel attraction.
What a special attraction to have at the state fair and to have it be hand carved here in Ohio. That's just remarkable.
Oh, it really is. You know, we're so excited. We'll be able to open the gates and let everyone come in and ride that carousel for the first time. It'll be a real wonderful experience. And there's a couple of unique options that we have on that as well. One is a toddler seat where, you know, often young children are sitting kind of on top of the animal and parents are holding them. Parent can still hold, but they're kind of sitting into the seat. So they're a little safer in that toddler seat. And we also have two chariots. One of the chariots is fully accessible. So someone in a wheelchair can hop on and, you know, get into that fully accessible chariot and be able to enjoy the carousel as well.
The rides, the games, the food, the livestock, the crafts, it's all there. The Ohio State Fair kicks off on the 29th and goes through August 9th. And Alicia Schultz, I can't thank you enough for being with us today to share all of this. And we're excited for the fair to start.
Thank you so much. I look forward to seeing you at the fair.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's Jay Fox.
Grocery prices in Columbus are up roughly 3% this year compared to last year. Ground beef leads the increases and increases with prices as much as 15% higher. The only good news is that chicken and eggs have come way down in price. Joining us now on Columbus Perspective is Jessica Fulton. She's a senior fellow at the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies. Welcome and good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
It's our pleasure. Jessica, grocery prices aren't the only thing that have gone up. What other consumer spending categories have been affected this year?
Yeah, so look, summer is really supposed to be a time when we're all able to spend more time with our family and friends and get outside and have a good time. But right now, that's really difficult for people across the country and in Columbus, especially because prices on the things we used to be able to afford are rising pretty rapidly. Since this time last year, the prices of things like groceries, utilities, gas, clothing, and even housing have all risen pretty rapidly. And what's most frustrating, I think, is that it doesn't have to be this way. There are policy choices, including the tariffs from last year, the war in Iran, pullbacks on healthcare and food assistance. Those things are raising prices on the things we need and making it difficult to make ends meet, including and especially, I think, gas prices, which people really notice on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, they do. You notice the gas prices on a day-to-day basis. You notice the food prices on a week-to-week basis. Do most people in Columbus, Ohio, do you think, understand what is causing the across-the-board inflation?
I imagine that they do because they see what's happening on the news and they can see the correlation. You know, Ohio is in a little bit of a better situation in terms of the cost of gas compared to the rest of the country. For example, according to AAA, Ohio's gas was about $3.70 a gallon as of yesterday. Columbus is a touch higher than that at $3.74 per gallon. But both of those are lower than the nationwide average of $3.84. But, and this is the thing that I think people really notice, gas was just $3.06 this time last year in Ohio. That's a 20% increase, and I'm not sure how many people's take-home pay went up enough to be able to absorb that extra expense. Brown University actually has a tracker that tracks the cost of gas just since the start of the conflict in the Middle East at the end of February. They find that Ohio households have spent an extra $280 per household on just gas prices since the war began. So I think there's something that people are able to notice when they pay attention to what's happening in the news and then when they look at what's happening at the gas pump.
Columbus residents say they feel on edge. Is this the general consensus nationwide, do you think?
Yeah, I think that people are really struggling, and a lot of folks are dealing with understanding the impact of multiple things that are happening in our economy. You know, we talked a little bit about gas prices. People are also really struggling with utility bills. There's a report just out from the think tank Third Way that says that average Ohio utility bills will be about $800 total for the summer, which is 17% higher than last summer. That's not only because of increases to gas prices because of the war in Iran. That's because of things like changes to clean energy policy. That's because of things like strains on our energy grids, right? And these are all things that I think are affecting the mindset of many Americans as people try to plan to have a good summer and to enjoy the rest of the year.
You alluded to the fact that Ohio's in a little bit better place than the national average. When you look at cities like Columbus and compare them to like market cities like perhaps Kansas City or Austin, Where does the capital of Ohio stand in relationship to some other similar cities?
You know, I don't have the data in front of me for Kansas City and Austin, but what I can say is that nationwide, we need our policymakers to really sit down and check in with the folks who are struggling and living paycheck to paycheck to understand what kinds of policies would really support them to help them make ends meet. You know, those solutions, there are places that are innovating and trying to make sure that people have support in the terms of energy assistance, support in terms of food assistance, you know, really helping them to make ends meet so that they're able to enjoy the rest of the summer.
When we think about the folks that are frustrated and they need a government entity to turn to, do these frustrated consumers see this as a local, state, or federal problem? Who's the go-to?
I would imagine that people who are looking for help are really looking for help from wherever they can get it. But I do think that the buck really stops at the federal government. The challenge is that issues like tariffs, issues like the Iran war, issues like making healthcare more affordable, those are issues that our federal policymakers could change. On the other side, even though Ohio is in a somewhat fortunate position of having a fairly low unemployment rate, unemployment rates don't measure how much people are earning. And so one thing that state and local policymakers can do is think about how to increase incomes for people, because with costs going up, if people can't get a raise or if they can't get more hours at work, they're going to have trouble making ends meet.
Well, and what people in Columbus who are having those problems are doing right now is they're rebudgeting. So they're eliminating things like going to a movie, having multiple platforms of entertainment to consume, taking vacations, going out to eat, things that were part of the normal Columbus experience last year or the year before have changed. So aside from rebudgeting, what other steps can people take to address these issues?
You know, a lot of people are really trying to turn to their community to try to get support. Things like food banks, which are experiencing a surge in need and have over the past year or so. And I think that those kinds of things make sense. I also think we really have to call on our policymakers to address these issues. The challenge is that people tend to think that when they can't afford to give their family a good life, that is their personal responsibility. And you do need to budget, and you do need to make sure that you're being mindful of your costs. But these are big structural problems, and we can't fix them on our own. And so we have to turn to our legislators to address the challenges that we see in these day-to-day issues.
And it's a different world when the people who used to volunteer at the food bank suddenly become the food bank's clients.
It sure is. It sure is.
So is there a website where folks can learn more about some of the surveys that were done on these issues? What's the best website for that?
Yes, you can take a look at the newest report on how prices are increasing nationwide at groundworkcollaborative.org. And the think tank Third Way has resources on price increases for energy in Ohio. And then, like I mentioned, Brown University actually has a tracker that's showing the cost increases since the war began in Ohio specifically.
All right. We want to thank Jessica Fulton for her time this morning. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's more from Jay Fox.
Mike Panuski is the county engineer for Lucas County, Ohio, and a longtime county official. He knows firsthand just how tough it can be to get transportation and infrastructure projects completed, and he also knows the challenges that counties face financially. In May, he was in Washington, D.C. for Infrastructure Week, working to secure funding for resurfacing and repair work. He joins us now on Columbus Perspective. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I am well. When you attend a session like this one, that you did back in May, how many other county engineers are present?
There's a whole bunch of county officials from all over the country. In terms of those who are county engineers, there's another three who are joining me here from across the country. And we're coming because it's very important for us to demonstrate to our federal office holders about the importance of infrastructure and the impacts it makes on their community.
Is everyone who's in attendance competing for a share of the same pool of money, or do you have a set figure that you can typically count on?
No, typically the way federal infrastructure money works is most of the time it is competitive, especially for local jurisdictions. Generally, states get a dedicated pool of money through several types of programs, but for local jurisdictions like your city or your county or your township, it's very competitive. So all the county officials that are here, we're all competing against each other to try to get a share of the pie, to come back to our communities and to make our communities better.
So of the roads in Ohio, what percentage is the county's responsibility to maintain versus, say, the state or the federal government?
Yeah, generally counties and local roadways are significantly more than what the state maintains. Like for myself, I maintain over 300 miles of roadways that are county roadways in my county. The townships have probably three times that many, and the cities in terms of local streets have even more. In terms of where your dollars go and how what the we call the last mile is a lot more in terms of roadways than you'd get from the state. Now, it's not to take away from what the states do, because they control most of the local roads that a lot of places, a lot of members of our community use to go from place to place and from city to city and from state to state. But without the last mile to get from those kind of major arterial roadways to your house or your business, it's just as important. You know, bad roads and bad bridges on that last mile typically have just as much of an adverse impact than if it had on a state highway.
Now, does all the money start at the federal level and trickle down, or does it start locally and trickle up? And where does that money come from? Is it taxation?
Yeah, so the money comes from a lot of sources. So federal money is used for what they call the federal highway network. So they typically be more of your major highways and bridges. That comes from federal appropriations, just from regular tax revenues. It also comes from the federal gas tax, which funds something known as the Highway Trust Fund. So that's where a lot of the federal funds come from. And every 5 years, they come up with a bill that essentially distributes those monies and establishes the programs to distribute those monies. And that's what we're here for now. The next kind of five-year bill is coming up right now. And actually, the House just released their version of the bill yesterday. It's called the Build America 250 Act. And that's where the federal monies come from, the federal programs. And then the state also has their own programs and their own ways to fund roadways. In Ohio, it's typically through gas tax revenues. So there's state gas tax as well as license plate fees. So the majority of money that goes for roadways in Ohio comes from gas taxes and license plate fees. And some local jurisdictions, especially cities, sometimes will have an income tax or a property tax they have dedicated to roads. To basically do what we call the match. So every local community has to match money from either the state or the federal government. And usually those match monies come from those sources of funds.
So given what's going on with the war in Iran and the situation with the Strait of Hormuz and the switch to summer blend gasoline and our problems with refineries and petroleum and rising gas prices, if we suspend the federal gas tax
and or suspend the state gas tax, what's that going to do to your road budget?
It'll devastate it. So that's the money that's used to fund those. If you cut those monies, if there isn't money coming from somewhere else, then we're not going to be able to fund the programs that we need to keep our roads in good shape. And, you know, every year you're able to do that, it tends to compound later. So it's kind of short term, maybe a short term gain for long term pain. But in reality, if they stop the federal or the state gas tax, there's no guarantee that it will show up in the gas price, because the way it works is that that tax is paid for by the distributor. It's not paid for at the pump by you or by the person who owns the gas station. It's actually paid for the distributor that actually provides the gas to that gas station. And there's no guarantee they'll pass those savings on. They could pocket them in their own pocket to pad their profits. They could do all kinds of things to buy new equipment. There's no guarantee that if they suspend the gas tax, that it's going to end up in the pockets of John Q. Public. What I will guarantee is that it won't end up in your roadways.
So that being said, given all of the consternation that you potentially could face as we get into the summer and fall months, which are prime months for road construction projects and bridge repair, how can you possibly plan if you don't know what's coming down the pike?
It is. It makes it very difficult. Like right now, most of the projects that we have lease going this year have been paid for because we've already let the contracts out and you have to have the monies available to be able to do that. What it will do is it will force us to make some pretty difficult decisions in future years about how we're going to fund those road projects. And also, you know, we're planning projects out 4, 5, 6 years in advance. If you cut monies now, essentially you're cutting your seed corn that you need to be able to plan those projects and design those projects so that, you know, 4 or 5 years down the road that you're not going to be able to build them because you didn't have the money now to be able to make it happen. So not only would it, could it do some impact immediately, but it also reverberates into future years because it takes away the funds now that you have to do to plan and to do the things you need to do for the project that's going to be built 4 or 5 years from now.
So we're now 70 years down the road from the Eisenhower Highway Act, and we are an additional 30 to 40 years plus that in some of our roads, bridges, rail overpasses and underpasses. When you look at the needs of the state of Ohio versus other states in the country, how bad is our situation in Ohio in terms of crumbling infrastructure?
Yeah, Ohio's kind of unique in terms of, they say Indiana's the crossroads of America, but in reality, you can make the case that it's Ohio. We have more bridges than really any other state. I think we're like third or fourth in the number of bridges that need to be maintained. We're like in the top 5 or 6 in terms of highways, especially in terms of interstate highways. And most of our highways were built, as you mentioned, between 40 to 50 years ago. And generally for a pavement, you're looking at a 25 to 30 year lifespan. If you're looking at a bridge, you're looking at a 50 to 75 year lifespan. So our infrastructure is coming to the point that we're starting to, it's starting to show its age. And anytime we show its age, both either in terms of its condition or it's in terms of its ability to support the commerce and society that we have today, it's definitely showing its strain. You know, our highway system was built for a condition that existed 50 to 60 years ago. And we have higher population. We have different ways to ship commerce. We have different ways that we're utilizing our roadways. And it's a lot difficult to try to catch up and try to retrofit that existing infrastructure to be able to meet today's needs.
We say that in Columbus all the time. Columbus, absolutely. Ohio was meant to be a town of 500,000 people, and we will be a town of 3 million people by 2035 if the estimates are correct. Our infrastructure, yep, in the capital city cannot support that.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, Columbus is a poster child for that. But the other cities in Ohio are just as much of a poster child for that as well in different ways. If you look at the Brent Spence Bridge, you know, the old Brent Spence Bridge was definitely built for a time and a condition that definitely does not exist now. You know, luckily in the IIJ or the bipartisan infrastructure law, we were able to get the funds that we need to, make a new connection on I-70 to make that viable for the people of the state of Ohio.
Well, that was a cross-state collaboration with Kentucky. They were as much a part of that as we were. Isn't that true?
Yes.
Right.
That is absolutely true. But because of the size of Ohio versus the size of Kentucky and the ability of basically to handle that size of an infrastructure project, Ohio's kind of taking a leading role to make that happen. Kentucky's definitely a part of it as well.
Well, that's why they call it the Ohio River and not the Kentucky River. So what do you do to make your case stand out and make Ohio, Lucas County, Toledo a priority? How do you differentiate yourself?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really important thing because different places have their own ways to differentiate themselves. And you have to know your community and you have to know what your state's needs are. And more importantly, you have to know what is the impact that will happen if we don't do that investment. So what's going to happen in terms of Ohio and the nation's competitiveness? What are the things that could happen if we don't make that investment? And what happens if we fail to act? And there's been a lot of reports and everything about how our failure to act and the fact that we've really disinvested in our infrastructure over the last 30 to 40 years. We're trying to make that up. We tried to make it up with the IIJA and in this bill that just dropped yesterday. We're trying to make it up again because it's a pretty good bill in terms of what it provides and recognizing that the need for infrastructure investment in America. But you have to make that case. Right? What happens? What happens if you don't? What happens to America if you don't? What happens to your community if you don't? In terms of competing not only against other communities in Ohio, other communities across the nation, but other nations across the world, and what's the impact that it has that you don't do it? And there's lots of stories you can tell.
If we see your face on a GoFundMe, we'll know exactly what happened.
Absolutely.
All right. We want to thank Mike Banuski, who's the county engineer for Lucas County, for shedding some light on infrastructure and the trials and tribulations of going after money to pay for all of these repairs. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Now, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10TV, here's Doug Petcash. From the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10TV.
It was just over 3 weeks ago when the U.S. Supreme Court effectively ended temporary protected status for Haitian immigrants living and working in the U.S. That includes an estimated 12,000 to 15,000 in the Springfield, Ohio area. Governor Mike DeWine has been very supportive of the Haitian community in and around Springfield. He said this after the June 25th Supreme Court ruling.
It is not in the United States' interest, certainly not in Ohio's interest, to have people who are working every single day, who are supporting a family, who are buying houses, fixing up old houses, starting businesses, and then put deep roots in this country and really are contributing and yank them out.
Joining me now to talk about the aftermath of the ruling ending temporary protected status for Haitian immigrants is Haitian community advocate, Pastor Carl Ruby. Sir, thank you for being here. And Haitian Support Center Executive Director and TPS holder himself, Viles Dorsonville. Viles, as well to you. Welcome to the show today.
Thank you for having me.
I want to start with you, Viles, if you don't mind. What are your thoughts today? You know, now a few weeks after this ruling came out, what are your major concerns?
Yeah, my major concerns are phone calls that we've continued to receive from folks from the community asking us questions that we don't have answer for. Questions that what will be happening to them and the children after the 24th of July. And you know that when the livelihood of folks are being threatened, it's a major concern because they won't be able to budget for themselves, for their families, and for their kids. This is a very major concern in our community.
And so the 24th of July is the date that you'll possibly get more answers.
Basically, after the ruling, it was supposed to be expired on the 10th of July, but it seems that there is some type of judicial back and forth between the Supreme Court and the lower court, especially Ana Reyes, to align with the decision of the Supreme Court, and they keep postponing it for the 24th.
Now, how about for yourself? How concerned are you? I know you're worried about a lot of other people in your community and taking care of them as well.
I'm on the same boat as everybody else. So I am a TPS holder and an asylum seeker as well. So the same fate of other folks, also my fate as well.
Dr. Ruby, you've been involved in this from the very beginning. What are you hearing from the people you help in the community and also the supporters?
Fear. I think what a lot of people don't understand is we've been living in limbo for a long time. So like the first time that we were told TPS was going to run out was way back in August of last year. So there have been a series of like deadlines that have come.
February was one also.
February. But we really feel like this is kind of the end of the line. There isn't another step beyond this. So there's confusion. A lot of them are just, I think there's, you know, we think about them worrying about sent back to Haiti. But a lot of what's going on right now is they're worrying about how to pay their bills next week, and how they're going to pay their rent and how they're going to have food on the table. And in some ways, that's a more immediate concern than being detained or deported.
Is the community rallying around them to try to help meet that need?
Yes. There are lots of nonprofits. St. Vincent de Paul is doing a wonderful job. Haitian Support Center is doing a wonderful job. But they are not resourced to take care of 10 to 15,000 people. And what's sad about this is it's just so unnecessary. They came to Springfield to work, like every other group of immigrants. And if they could just be allowed to work, they wouldn't need aid. But this is a loss not only for Haitians, but it's a huge loss for Springfield.
Vilas, are you seeing some people already like self-deporting, whether they're going to Haiti or somewhere else?
Basically, these are some of the options that folks are exploring. Those of them maybe who have family members in Canada, they are trying to see if there is a way that they can go there. But self-deporting is one of the options, but it should be the last option for folks because of the condition of the country, of Haiti right now. So I am not aware of folks taking that decision yet, but it might be the next decision to take if there is any other alternative.
What are your options then to stay here, or what are your community's options? Is it, you had mentioned you're seeking asylum as well, and you did that, I believe, apply for that a while back, right?
Yeah. But options that I can mention here is that for the community as a whole, if they have a child who turns 21, the child can petition for them. If they have spouse can petition for them to adjust the status. Other than that, for those of them who left Haiti for a particular reason, it might be a political reason. They were in politics and they became the target. They can apply for asylum because asylum is the only option that they have now, even though I think that it might not consider it as a safe status, but this is the status that they can explore to have now. This is why so many Haitians now who left Haiti because of a particular reason, because you cannot apply for asylum just like that. You have to be politically targeted when you were in Haiti, or you were part of a group that normally denounced the bad governance of the government. So those folks now, they're exploring the possibility to apply for asylum.
Dr. Ruby, you and Vilas both and others in your organization with G92, the different churches that have come together to help the Haitian community, have been to Washington, D.C. a couple times at least now when the Supreme Court was considering the case and making the ruling. The U.S. House did pass a bill to extend temporary protected status for Haitian and other immigrants. Do you have any hope right now of that
happening in the Senate as well?
Yeah, I think we need to do everything possible to try to get our senators to support that. What concerns me is they don't need to just pass with a majority. They need to pass with a veto-proof majority. And that's a big challenge.
So you worry that the president would veto it?
Well, I'm certain he'd veto it.
Supporters of ending TPS have said the program is intended to be temporary. It's temporary protected status. Many Haitians have been living here under the status since after the devastating earthquake of 2010. So I guess why should Haitians be allowed to stay under TPS if it is a program, as they argue, that is temporary?
Well, first of all, I would encourage them to read the law that established TPS under George Herbert Walker Bush. And what it says is that, number one, it only applies to people who are already here. It doesn't allow people to come in. For people who are already here, they can apply for temporary protective status so they are not sent back to a place that is dangerous. And the law only allows for three options. When the temporary TPS period ends, the president is allowed to do a thorough investigation and determine that it is safe and then terminate TPS. Or if they determine that it's not safe, they can extend another period. So instead of, we're going to give you another 2 years of protected status.
So it's 18-month increments.
Yeah, or they can expand it and allow new people to apply for TPS. There's no condition that allows a president to end TPS without doing a study to prove that it's safe to send them back. That doesn't exist.
Again, that's courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV, from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV. This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan, heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS FM 97.1 The Fan and on 1460 AM The Fan 2.